24/7, 365 on 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Tune in for the best local programming.
I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're going to try to understand what Iranian Canadians are going through right now.
What we should be aware of is that our prime minister just f***ed this up royally at the G7.
Wait for that.
We begin tonight with breaking news from the Middle East. Israel has launched a series of airstrikes on Iran's nuclear and military sites. It is a dramatic escalation in a long-running conflict between the two countries.
They targeted Iran's ability to attack and defend. They targeted key military leaders. And they targeted the country's nuclear program.
When Syria's President Bashar al-Assad was overthrown in December 2024, Israel took the opportunity to destroy any remaining threats to Israel's air force within Syria, effectively creating a safe corridor for future strikes on Iran.
Israel has done the world a favor. We're a safer place right now.
Friday evening, Carney posted Canada's position on social media, saying Iran's nuclear program has long been a cause of grave concern, and its missile attacks across Israel threaten regional peace. Canada reaffirms Israel's right to defend itself and to ensure its security. We call on all parties to exercise maximum restraint and move towards a diplomatic resolution.
While some Israeli leaders speak openly of regime change in Tehran.
So are you going to target the Supreme Leader?
We're doing what we need to do. More is on the way. The regime doesn't know what hit them. They don't know what will hit them.
A short time ago, the U.S. military carried out massive precision strikes on the three key nuclear facilities in the Iranian regime, Fordo, Natanz, and Esfahan. Tonight, I can report to the world that the strikes were a spectacular military success. Iran's key nuclear enrichment facilities have been completely and totally obliterated.
There's a secret club in Canada. And trust me, you do not want to be a member. If you are in this club, your first response when you hear news about bombs and death and carnage in the Middle East, your first response is not to hop onto Twitter or Facebook to post your political opinion about it. No, your first response is to make a long-distance phone call to try to find out if your family and friends over there are still alive. Lebanese Canadians are in this club. Palestinian Canadians are in this club. Jewish Canadians are in this club. And last week, hundreds of thousands of Iranian Canadians joined this club too. They are now the largest group in this club. Like I said, I hope for you that you are not in this club. I hope nobody else has to join it. We don't want new members. Today I'm going to talk to two Iranian Canadians with very different perspectives about what has happened since Israel struck Iran last week. What it means, what it might mean. We're going to talk politics, yes, but we are also just going to talk about what they are going through, what their hopes and fears are, and how the rest of Canada, the Carney government, and the rest of us, their neighbors, how we can help. Wait for it.
I am Amir Antarin. I'm a law professor at the University of Ottawa.
Amir, my first question is, do you have any people in Iran who are in danger, who you're, you know, trying to check in with? Are your people accounted for and okay?
We don't know. Communications are pretty spotty right now. The internet is scarcely working in Iran. I have read, don't know, that even local phone calls aren't going through very often. As for using, you know, FaceTime or the usual ways that we stay in touch from Canada, that's just not working right now. I had a little taste of it last night because turns out that my cousin's wife, who was on a visit to Iran, is there. We can't reach her at the moment, and of course she can't come back.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. That's very stressful. I know a lot of Canadians with people in Israel and in Iran are going through this. This is going to be a difficult conversation. I can't imagine that when you're worried for people's well-being and struggling to get in touch with them, you're reflecting on the larger picture of things. I'm grateful for your time and your thoughts today. What is the mood beyond the obvious of stress and tension and worry? My understanding from our last conversation and from what I've read and what I've heard from Iranian Canadians is that there's like almost unilateral opposition to the regime. It must be complicated. How are people feeling about what's going on?
Well, I think you have a multitude of feelings at play at the same time. Sure, most of the Iranian community that is outside Iran, the diaspora, does not feel warmly towards the Islamic regime. Hardly care for that regime. I would very much like to see it gone, but that's not a sentiment I have unique to Iran. I'd like to see Donald Trump gone. I'd like to see Benjamin Netanyahu gone. And on top of that, you know, the feeling that they should go, there is a definite sense it is not Israel and America's job to make them go. And in fact, what Israel and the United States are doing gives rise to a different feeling, that of anger. Iran was on a more progressive turn lately. The new president, Pezeshkian, has been liberalizing. You don't get that easily in Iran. That was very hard won to see that in this tightly controlled political system, a more liberal-minded president was permitted by the religious authorities and the Revolutionary Guards to have power. You can pretty much count on that progress being reversed if there is going to be a larger or more enduring military intervention in Iran. The revanchist forces will gain the upper hand again. And, you know, what Iranians have struggled for, including by blood, to liberalize their daily lives, is now in peril. So no one is expressing any thanks to Israel and the United States for this. They are completely counterproductive in what they're doing.
No one's expressing any thanks, but are people daring to hope? I take the point fully that people want to be masters of their own destiny and they want to have self-determination and they don't want to have regime change violently thrust upon them. Israel is saying, we're doing this to stop Iran's nuclear program. We're doing this because Iran has been funding Hamas and Hezbollah. Maybe the people will rise up and there'll be regime change. Trump is going a bit more heavy into complete surrender. It's time for regime change. Are those thoughts laughed at as like a fantasy? Because you seem to be presenting as a fait accompli, this will make things worse. There is no way that this is going to make things better. Do people dare to hope? Well, this may not be the way that we want regime change, but this is the opportunity, and history doesn't always follow your favorite choice for how things happen. You take the opportunity where you can.
Look, I mean, it's impossible to generalize. Of course, some people are hoping for that. I think they're pretty ignorant. I think anyone who's studied the situation knows that in the event of regime change, it's going to be disastrous, and not just for Iran, but for the entire region, for Israel, for the United States. You just have to look at the track record here, okay? The United States sought regime change in Afghanistan. It got mired in a war. It fought it uselessly. It did not even achieve its aim of catching bin Laden in Afghanistan. It fought against the Taliban for years and ultimately gave up, went home. The Taliban resumed their power over Afghanistan. What about Iraq? Similar story. The United States decides regime change is necessary because of a fake claim of weapons of mass destruction. That is found to be fake, but the U.S. spills enormous amounts of blood. ISIS gains hold in the region. Nothing good came of that war either. And Iraq is still a weak state. What about Libya? Similar story again. Eliminating Gaddafi has left a vacuum in which militias, terrorist ones, have projected power across all of North and West Africa. This doesn't work. If you try the same thing three times in 25 years and it screws up every single time, you have to be lunatic to think it's going to work in Iran. Seriously lunatic. And so those of us who, I think, understand the history of U.S. intervention, egged on by Israel. You recall Israel was very much egging on the invasion of Iraq. Israel at the time was saying, while you're at it, do Iran. They have the capacity to build a bomb imminently. They said that in 2003, or 20 years later, they still haven't built a bomb. These false pretenses justifying quote-unquote regime change against international law have never worked out well. And they're not going to work well this time.
The narrative that is coming through a lot of media commentary on this is different. This is being hailed as an incredible act of military precision and bravado, a spectacular military operation by Israel, and one that the world should be thanking Israel for, because the hundreds of casualties that we're seeing now compared to what might occur had Iran been allowed to continue to build its nuclear program and if it had reached capacity as a nuclear power. And it is true that Iranian officials and the president and Ayatollahs have been threatening to wipe Israel off the map and to destroy Israel for decades. The story that is being projected out there is that this is an incredible gift to humanity, that we are avoiding that outcome. I am going to assume that you are somewhat skeptical of that argument.
I mean, a few reactions to that. First of all, sure, Iran has been saying that garbage for years, right? We're going to destroy Israel. Israel has been saying the garbage for years that Iran is imminently to have a bomb. You can't trust either of these mendacious countries. You can't. I mean, they're both lying. The U.S. too. I mean, principally, the gall that the U.S. had to lie to its closest allies in 2003 to enter a war in Iraq, saying weapons of mass destruction were there. Or how efficiently the targeting of Israel was done. Israel has a very sophisticated military. It can target. It has the best technology in the world, thanks to the United States. It uses that fine targeting technology not to best effect. It uses it indiscriminately. And in Gaza, the entire place is leveled with precision bombs. That's the irony, right? The whole place leveled with the most precise bombs that only attack the things you want to attack. So in Iran, I wouldn't say it's been as finely targeted as those who you were summarizing would put it. I mean, just yesterday, Israel hit the main police building in Tehran. Now, the police aren't military, okay? Sure, they play a nasty role in an authoritarian state, no doubt. But if you take out the police and then you take out the regime, could you be doing more to bring about chaos? Israel is targeting the police because it is trying to sow chaos. Chaos in Iran is not going to be in anyone's interest. That's not precise targeting.
Since October 7th, there has been an Iranian-Canadian presence in support of Israel. I am wondering, and I brought up that counter-narrative to ask you, is anybody happy about this? Is anybody hopeful because of this?
I think those that are foolishly so. Yeah, of course there are. I mean, there's a lot of Iranian-Canadians. I mean, you will find among them examples of every opinion, right? It's a big biodiverse community of ideas that those people hold. But what I'm trying to impress on you is, for those who think rationally about it, no good can come of this. And I think also, to take it one step further, Jesse, for those who think rationally about it, the premise for a preemptive war, I suppose that's what Israel is characterizing it as, is A, illegal, and B, not ethical. I mean, look at the very premise of this. Israel has to destroy Iran before it gets nuclear weapons. Israel itself has nuclear weapons. It's had them since the 1960s. That's when its program got underway. The U.S. is the only country in the world to have used nuclear weapons. We have two nuclear weapon countries saying that they have the right to prevent another country acquiring exactly what they've got. I mean, this is the hypocrisy of the highest order.
I know why that doesn't matter to them, right? The notion that they should allow a country that has sworn to annihilate them to also acquire nuclear weapons because that would be fair is not one that's going to carry much water.
I think the appropriate outcome here, Jesse, is Israel gives up its nuclear weapons and Iran does. You can't have a situation where Israel is pointing a nuclear arsenal at Iran saying, don't you dare do the same to us. And that is exactly the reality of it. And yet, Mark Carney, the G7, falls in line with Israel's narrative about their right to defense. The G7 communique, you know, that mentioned Israel's right to defense, but not Iran's. That's a problem. What we should be aware of is that our prime minister just f***ed this up royally at the G7.
Let's talk about the G7. Here's what they just said. And this is Canada and the other G7 nations. We, the leaders of the G7, reiterate our commitment to peace and stability in the Middle East. In this context, we affirm that Israel has a right to defend itself. We reiterate our support for the security of Israel. We also affirm the importance of the protection of civilians. Iran is the principal source of regional instability and terror. We have been consistently clear that Iran can never have a nuclear weapon. That's to read from that statement. So it seems like the narrative that I just described is one that the G7 is like fully invested in.
They are. And I think it's insanity. I mean, it's not even correct. Iran has not gone to war except through proxies who do have some agency of their own. It's made to appear they don't. We have just seen Mark Carney propagate a lie such an extent that my support for him is out the window. My honeymoon period is already over. No, Iran is not the principal threat. It's Israel right now. They're not done yet. What we are failing to see as Westerners is that Israel's on a bender here. It's damaging its relations and its neighbors severely. That indicates it's lost its calm judgment since October 7th. And now it's about to do the same to Iran. Archie started, I suppose. And that will have no good ending. Why? Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, no good endings. This one won't have it either. Second of all, the available evidence, including from the Director of National Intelligence in the U.S., is that Iran is years from a bomb. Third of all, that containment and rapprochement with Iran has been working. The Saudis showed us that. They have really brought down their tensions with Iran. If diplomacy is working, you do not press the launch button on a war. And that is something that Israel blew. Israel should be called out for that. It should not be said, as Mr. Carney did, that Iran is the principal source of instability right now. That's Israel. These realities were lost in the G7. They were lost because of our prime minister. I don't know what political calculation he's making, but what he is doing is he is paving the road to war. We are in for decades, not years, decades, could be a century of real trouble in the entire region, because Iran is a far more significant country by numbers, by history, by technology, than Afghanistan, Libya, or Iraq ever were. This is the moment at which that set of mistakes is about to be repeated in a vastly more inflammable crucible.
Thanks, Amir. All right, after the break, we're going to be speaking with somebody with a very different perspective on what's going on.
My name is Kaveh Shirouz. I'm an Iranian-Canadian. I'm a lawyer, a human rights activist, and a senior fellow with the McDonald Laurier Institute.
Hi, Kaveh.
Hi, good to be with you, Jesse.
Before we get into it, how are you doing in terms of checking in on family? How's your family doing? Do you have people that you have that you're worried about in Iran?
Yeah, I appreciate you asking. It's a tough time. It's a tough time for me and everybody that's, everybody obviously that's in the country, but those of us that are outside are worried sick. I have a lot of family back in Iran, and unfortunately, the last time I was able to talk to them was about 48 hours ago. That's when the regime cut off the internet, so it's hard to access anybody now. My family is mostly concentrated in Tehran. Some of them have managed to leave and go to the north where they think it's a little bit safer. Some members of my family are elderly. One is hospitalized, so they're kind of just trapped in Tehran, and they're waiting for the bombs to fall. So hopefully they will be safe.
And there has been, from Israel, advice, I guess, to evacuate a city of 10 million people. Kind of an impossibility for 10 million people to evacuate.
Yeah, regrettably, it seems like these pieces of advice, or whatever you want to call them, they're more kind of cover-your-ass statements than actually a desire to get civilians out, because it's impractical what they're asking people to do.
I know that no one person can represent any one community, but I think it's possible for us to try to understand the different points of view. And my understanding, based on our last conversation and based on just living a life in Toronto amongst Persians, is that there's almost universal opposition to the regime. And that's why Iranian people are in Canada for the most part. But it's more complicated than that, isn't it?
It certainly is. And when it comes to the war, things get all tangled up. So, yeah, I think in the circles in which we move, you and I, you will find an almost universal hatred of this regime. There are pockets of support for the regime. You might find it in the local Shiite mosques or whatever in Toronto, places I don't frequent, but I know they exist. But when it comes to the war, I think the views are more complicated. There are those who, in certain pockets that I referenced, oppose war because they just want this regime to stay in power and they want it to be powerful. So that's one group. But even among those who oppose the regime, there are different points of view. Some want the war to continue to the point where this regime falls. And then there are others who want the war to stop because, A, they think perhaps Israeli intention in this case is not good, but more importantly, they're concerned that inevitably there will be mass casualties. And they've seen, you know, what's happened to Gaza in the past, you know, couple of years, and they don't want any city in Tehran to turn into Gaza.
Is there a concept that a war that is fought like this, that is so far, and these are very early moments, the casualties have been limited and Israel is being praised by some for the surgical precision and for targeting the chain of command and the nuclear facilities, though there have been civilian casualties, absolutely. Is there a hope that this could prevent some kind of a ground war? This could prevent some kind of a, what everybody's been watching in Gaza, destruction block by block. Better to get it over with. Is there hope for that?
Yeah, that sentiment definitely exists. In fact, I would put myself in that camp. So far, I've been watching what the IDF has done, and I don't want to obviously write anybody a blank check, but if Israel continues to do what it has been doing, I don't see much of a problem with it. I mean, their attacks have been fairly targeted. Regrettably, there will be civilian casualties. You know, when you blow up a condo unit in which some bigwig of the Iranian regime lives, there are bound to be neighbors or whatever that get hurt, and that's an incredible tragedy, but that's just the reality of modern warfare. I remain hopeful that these kinds of attacks will degrade the Iranian regime's capabilities such that they will eventually have to surrender. And hopefully that will lead to a fairly quick change in regime.
I heard a very different point of view, which won't surprise you, from Amir Adaran. And his point of view was that no good could come of this and that Iran was already moving towards a self-correction, that the regime was becoming more liberal and tolerant, that the country was becoming more free, that they're not the same crackdowns on women for how they dress, and that an internal self-guided move towards more civil liberties and freedom was always going to be a better path than some violently imposed change to government. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that point of view.
I mean, I think if you were to talk to Amir Attaran 3 years ago, he would have said the same. 5 years ago, he would have said the same. 20 years ago, he would have said the same. There is a contingent of Iran watchers who have been singing the same tune since the late 90s when a so-called reform movement took place. And every time we're told to keep waiting because better times are ahead. You know, things are liberalizing, things are opening up, but it never actually does. Maybe there will be moments, months at a time, where enforcement of the hijab is reduced, or, you know, space opens up a little bit for journalists to write some articles. But then immediately after, within 6 months, there's a crackdown and things go back to the way they were. There is something about the DNA of this very regime that's unreformable. It does not liberalize. It needs to go. And I think, you know, with the exception of a few progressives like Dr. Attaran here in the West and a handful of people back in Iran, nobody believes this reform talk anymore. I think people have moved on. You have heard it in the slogans that people chant when they come out in the streets. They did, a couple of years ago with the Woman Life Freedom Movement. One of the key chants was, you know, reformists and hardliners, you know, your time's up. Basically, the rejection of, you know, this game of these two different factions of the same regime. And you see it in the articles they publish and so on. The people of Iran have moved on. I would recommend that Dr. Attaran do the same.
What about the people of Canada, the Iranian-Canadian people? It's just really hard to get a handle on what the consensus is or what the camps are, because there have been some very vocal members of the Iranian-Canadian community in the Free Palestine movement, very, very vocal and outspoken critics of Israel. And then there are also Iranians who have been a constant presence in rallies that have been for bringing the hostages home, rallies that are solidarity with Israeli people, if not the Israeli government. So there is the public presentation and the loudest voices have been diametrically opposed in terms of support or condemnation of Israel. I don't know what to infer from that about where the mainstream is at, or, you know, household to household.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a large community and there are a lot of different views, but there is a reason why you see the same five Iranian people at the Palestinian protests and the same five people showing up at all the hard right Israeli protests. That's because they're minority voices. I think the vast majority of the members of our community are somewhere in the middle. My feeling, based on a lot of conversations, is that on average, there is more sympathy for Israel among the Iranian community than you would find among any other Middle Eastern group. We share a common enemy in the Islamic regime in Tehran. I think people are aghast at kind of what they've seen happen in Gaza. I don't think anyone's in favor of that. But the sympathy still lies, I would say, by and large, with Israel. My sense is it's the same with this war. I think in talking to members of my community, but also in talking to, you know, when I had the opportunity to talk to members of my family and friends back in Iran before the internet was shut off, there is a lot of anger, but most of the anger about this war is directed at the regime itself and not at Israel.
I imagine you're going to get pushback from people around the idea that there is widespread sympathy for Israel, but I think that the operative question is not so much how many Iranian Canadians support Israel, because I'm not sure how much it matters how much any Canadians support or abhor Israel. I guess I'm more curious about what degree of hope is interwoven with the anxiety and fear and concern for family. If the dreams of the diaspora is for this regime to fall, this might not be the best way for it to happen. But is there a hope that the silver lining is, even for those who are virulently opposed to Israel, is there, well, we'll take it if this is the opportunity, then there is a way that this could shake out for the better.
Those that are fundamentally opposed to Israel probably don't think along these lines. But for the others, I would say there are several possibilities, several possible outcomes from this war. And one of them, and I don't know how likely it is, all these different outcomes, what the probability of each one is, but one possible outcome is for this regime to fall because of a popular uprising that comes as a result of it, and that a democracy of some kind, a secular democracy, takes shape. So I know that a fair number of people still maintain that hope, but there are other outcomes that are very bleak. And, a coup d'etat that sort of maintains this regime just in a slightly different form, or a civil war, I mean, those would be disastrous outcomes, and they're not unlikely. Again, I don't know the percentage likelihood, but they're not unlikely outcomes. But there is a sliver of hope.
What do you think? Because I've heard it argued that how, after Iraq and Afghanistan, how could we think that a violently imposed change to government, it hasn't gone so well in that region in the past. So why would we imagine it would go any better this time?
Well, it might go better because Iran in 2025 is not Afghanistan in 2001 or Iraq in 2003 or whatever it was that the attack occurred. Iran has a long, long history of its citizens yearning for democracy and struggling for democracy. Iran had a constitutional revolution as far back as 1906, and it actually was successful for a brief while, and then problems arose and dictatorship took hold again. And then there was, again, movement towards democracy in 1979. There was hope for democracy, at least. It didn't materialize. This was always sort of in the air. And then in the last few years, you know, we've seen uprising after uprising in Iran, people wanting democracy. And Iran has, despite the efforts of the regime, Iran has something resembling a vibrant civil society. There are, you know, labor unions. They're repressed, but they exist. There are human rights groups repressed, but they exist. All sorts of NGOs that try to do things for Iranians. So the basic infrastructure of a democratic system exists in Iran in a way it did not in places like Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya. That gives me hope. Now, obviously, you know, if the war becomes gruesome the way it has in Gaza, for example, and there's mass destruction, that civil society will go with it. But if the fall of this regime is pretty quick as a result of military action, then I think there is actually hope that something resembling democracy may take root.
Are you happy with the Prime Minister's response and the statement that was put out from Canada and G7 partners?
The Prime Minister's statement was better than what we initially saw from Foreign Minister Anand, you know, a recognition of the threat that Israel faces and so on. What I would like to see, and maybe I'm dreaming, but what I'd like to see is an actual regime change policy adopted by Canada and other G7 countries. I think we have to recognize that Iran's regime is not one that the civilized world can live with. And until we get there, I'm going to keep criticizing statements from Canada and the Western countries.
Beyond making statements about regime change, what could our government here in Canada do?
Training and intelligence for its opposition, those would be very useful. Quite honestly, I mean, just a few minutes ago, we were talking about the fact that our opposition is divided and there's no clear alternative to this regime. I think what the West can do, what would be most useful for the West to do, would be to basically try to create that unified opposition. I know that sounds far-fetched and it sounds like, why would the West get into that? But I think we do need a little push, frankly. I would love to see a conference of some kind or a meeting of some kind that Western governments put together that brings the opposition together, basically sits them down in a room and says, look, we need you guys to compromise and put together a united front. I think we need some outside help, and I would love to see Canada take the lead on that.
Returning to a different point of view, I heard from Dr. Adaran, he said that what Canada and the world should be asking for is a demand for mutual nuclear disarmament of both Israel and Iran.
Sure. In a fantasy world, I would like to see no country have nuclear weapons, but I don't see that as realistic. I don't see it as realistic for Israel to give up its nuclear weapons. But also, Israel is not the one going around threatening to wipe any country off the map, right? So in the real world, the country that is racing towards a nuclear weapon and that's threatening its neighbors constantly, that's the one that shouldn't have the nuclear weapon. So Dr. Asaran can pursue nuclear disarmament globally, that's fine, but I think what is achievable and what is absolutely necessary at the moment is for Iran not to get a nuclear weapon.
Do you have in mind a best and a worst case scenario?
One would be that the regime is severely weakened, but it stays in place. And what I suspect it will do is that it will carry out, you know, human rights abuses, the likes of which we haven't seen. So the last time we had this occur was in the 80s when Iran was forced to accept a ceasefire and an end to its war with Iraq. And that was when it carried out some of the worst killings in contemporary Iranian history. We also saw this with Saddam Hussein, I think a similar sort of regime. When he lost the first Gulf War, that's when he carried out the Anfal campaign against the Kurds and just massacred the Kurds. So dictatorial totalitarian regimes tend to lash out when they're weakened and humiliated. So that's one horrendous outcome. The other horrendous outcome would be a civil war. It was really alarming, for example, the other day to see the Jerusalem Post's editorial board actually recommend the partition of Iran, because I think that's the kind of thing that just, it angers Iranians, and whatever goodwill we've been talking about that Iranians might have towards the West and Israel, I think that would disappear instantly. But also, it's just a recipe for disaster and civil war and mass killings and so on. So those two, I think, are the worst case scenarios. Best case scenario is the one that I'm working towards and hoping we will achieve, which is a popular uprising. I think if the regime is sufficiently degraded in terms of its security capabilities and military capabilities, and if the bombing stops for a brief while where people can actually come out in the streets and take over institutions, that would be the beginning of the end of this regime and the beginning of the creation of a secular democratic system in Iran.
How should Canadians just be good to their neighbors right now? What's the best that Canadians can do for their Iranian-Canadian neighbors?
Yeah, this sounds really banal, but just, you know, just talk to them, just check in on them. I mean, do for Iranians what Canadians have so graciously done for Ukrainians and others. Ask them how they're doing. Ask them how their family is doing. Is there something I can do for you? I mean, we're all going through a pretty hard time, especially now, because we can't even talk to our families back in Iran. Just be kind to each other. Yeah, there is a time and place for political debates and disagreements, but at the end of the day, this is a very, very human story. We're all scared that our moms and dads and aunts and uncles are going to be killed. So just be kind. I have nothing beyond something banal like that to offer. But just, I think people understand human kindness everywhere.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks so much, Jesse. Appreciate it.
That is your Canada Land. Hope you enjoyed it. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Caleb Thompson. Today's episode was fact-checked by Julian Abraham. Max Collins is our director of audio. I am the editor and publisher around here. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
I'm San Graywall, and today we're talking about the news. We'll stay in Alberta, where we talk about how a plan to mine the hell out of the majestic, awe-inspiring, Canada-defining Rockies gets you this reaction.
Sometimes you get into government and you inherit problems that are many decades.
Wait for that. Cole Bennett, Substacker and independent journalist transplanted from Manitoba to Edmonton, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
More strong mayor powers in provinces where conservative premiers look to erode local democracy. A new Ontario Privacy Commissioner's report that revealed the use of, quote, code words by government officials to hide information from the public after a similar report out of Alberta last month. But the biggest bombshell dropped on democracy in this country had to be the news from a packed town hall last week. Let's play some more of that clip because I just cannot stop listening to it.
I have been a property rights advocate since 1997, and that is why we changed our Bill of Rights to say that if anyone has their property taken from them for public use, they would get full, fair, and timely compensation. That applies just as much to surface landowners as it does to subsurface landowners. And so that's the situation we inherited. That is the problem my energy minister and my environment minister have been trying to solve. If we do nothing, then we're told we'll likely lose those cases and have to pay 14. It would be $14 billion of payments. So what we're trying to do is to try to find a common ground.
So what you're hearing is the United Conservative Party of Alberta Premier Danielle Smith getting booed in Fort McLeod, a small town in southern Alberta. Cole, what do you know about this and how did we get here?
I'll start off by saying that, you know, one thing Albertans are united in is that they don't want coal mining in the Rockies. This is something that has been made clear for decades, literally. We have to go back to 1976, there was a coal policy implemented, and they basically designated land into four categories, with category one being the most restricted and category four being the least restricted. And so that policy was in place until June of 2020. Jason Kenney was the premier of Alberta at the time, same party as Danielle Smith today, and they quietly rescinded the 1976 coal policy, and they opened up previously protected lands for coal mining, specifically in the Rockies. And there was intense backlash from the public. They had to walk that policy back, and they banned coal mining again. In the midst of all that, companies had come in and bought leases, believing that they were going to be able to start coal mining. So Jason Kenney goes back, he bans coal mining again. In 2022, Danielle Smith becomes premier. In 2025, they allowed for coal exploration to proceed in the Rockies.
We are going to be banning any new open pit mines and mountaintop removal, making sure best available technology is used to manage water, and where possible, start using some of the new underground mining techniques to avoid disturbing the surface. The Coal Committee also had four advanced projects that they said could proceed, and those are going through the regulatory process.
And the reason for it was that they were slapped with multiple lawsuits. And they don't allow mining in the Rockies. Essentially, the government's going to be on the hook for around $14 billion, is what Danielle Smith claims. There's a lot of debate about what these coal companies could actually sue for, what's possible. But the reality is there's been public consultation on this, and it is overwhelmingly the consensus that nobody wants this. And I think people are a little bit beside themselves on why we are moving forward with this at all.
And we know from some reporting in the National Observer just last month that Adrian Tanner suggested that, you know, Alberta yearns for these coal mines. And obviously, from what you've just described, that couldn't be further from the truth.
Danielle Smith refers to not a referendum. It was in Crow's Nest Pass where residents got to kind of cast their vote as whether they wanted coal mining or not. You have to remember that Crow's Nest Pass is a town that lives and exists only because of coal mining, essentially. That is the economy there. And so, as you can see across Canada, there are many towns that are ghost towns now because there's no mining that takes place in them anymore. And so I can certainly feel for the residents of Crow's Nest Pass. 70% of the people that voted said they wanted mining to continue. But when we're talking in terms of mining, it doesn't just affect the town that's there. Like, we're talking about water runoff that is going hundreds of miles downstream and can affect millions of people. So to say that, well, it's only up to the residents that are in that specific area, I think is really disingenuous. And Danielle Smith has referred to that vote many times, saying that people want this. The people in the area want this. So I don't know what you mean about people don't want mining in the Rockies that's next door to them. But like I say, I think that's very disingenuous of her to make the claim that it, you know, it only essentially affects them, which is just not true. Also, we are a province, not just individual little towns and municipalities that get to do whatever they want. And the majority of Albertans overwhelmingly do not want coal mining in the Rockies. Danielle Smith has granted the authority for these companies to do what we call as exploration. So it's not full out mining, but it's getting them down the road farther to where they may have a full-on mine. We've also seen environmental studies from the Crow's Nest Past mine, the Grassy Mountain project, that were rejected originally. They said, you know, this is going to have serious environmental impacts. And the mine was originally rejected by federal and provincial oversight. They say the exploration is different. Well, yes, exploration is much different than actual mining, but we are going further down the path in terms of getting to an actual mine. And I worry also that as we get further down the path, these companies are pouring more money in and they're believing that there's more of a possibility that they're actually going to get to a mine. Like, this is going to be a problem that's not only playing out today, but if the exploration continues, it's going to continue to play out for years to come.
Just a little bit of context. So this coal mining that there could be, you know, some early exploration for. And as Cole said, we don't know where that's going to lead. But obviously, if you want to do the exploration, there's a reason for it. You want to mine it. And it's to produce steel. What we've seen in places like British Columbia, where the Elk Valley coal mines, which are also used for steel production, they release almost 2 million tons of greenhouse gases every year. That's the equivalent of 650,000 cars and light trucks. So not even addressing the potential threat to the Canadian Rockies. And I don't know if there's any way to overstate like how important the Rockies are to Canadians in so many different ways. You know, coal is bad. Let's make that crystal clear. There's no such thing as clean coal. Like what the industry will tell you about advances in steel production and the use of coal, you know, to make it like a lot less worse than it was in the past. That's like saying there's such a thing as clean natural gas. This is just industry spin. Danielle Smith, she has literally said that this would be good for the environment because for the transition to a clean economy, you know, an alternative energy economy, you need steel for certain processes to build out that clean energy economy.
A metallurgical coal is incredibly valuable. You need it for steel to make wind turbines. You need it as a component to be able to make solar panels. You just cannot make wind turbines and solar panels without metallurgical coal. So whether it's old economy type of energy or new economy energy, we have to have a more reasonable approach to mining operations. And so we can address the environmental concerns, but we have to be prepared to work with industry partners so that we can get these things developed.
Whether it's for the supposed environmental concern of Danielle Smith's or maybe to save a legal headache with this lawsuit or if there's something else behind it, there's definitely been some reporting and some pretty good local reporting. But why does it seem that we Canadians, we don't know enough about this?
You always have to differentiate what Danielle Smith says and what's actually true, which is any politician. She's really good at saying whatever she needs to say in that moment to just calm people down, literally the people that are standing in front of her. Unfortunately for her at that town hall, that didn't work. But like going back to the environmental concerns, when we're talking about water contamination, which is a real possibility here with the selenium that could be coming out of these mines and contaminating water, going downstream to, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Albertans, water is something, it's really difficult to clean it up and it's really difficult to get back. And it's one of the most valuable resources in the world. And also the Rockies, that is a part of Alberta. That is kind of who we are. It's part of our identity. And I think most Albertans across political lines share the same vision that we really don't want to disrupt that in any way. You know, that is a part of who we are and we want to protect those lands. And I think Danielle Smith, she's maybe a little bit embedded with these big companies and the idea of industry and creating jobs, which in some sense might be good. But when the province is telling you they don't want it, they don't want it. Let's just be clear about that. What her goal is here politically, I don't know. I really don't know. And I think that's what stumps a lot of people is, what is the real reason behind this? And people struggle to find that answer because it's just unclear how this benefits her, first of all, because a lot of things she does need to benefit her in order for her to do them, politically, I mean. And how does this benefit Albertans? Like, the economic impact we're going to have from this is very little. She's even said herself that we could get a couple $100 million in royalties. What's a couple $100 million in royalties in the grand scheme of things? I'm sure we can find something else where we can get some economic impact and we're not polluting the water and mining the mountains. So I'm not sure where she gets this idea that we need to move forward on this. And I think that's what really stumps a lot of people.
After the break, we're not picking on only Alberta. There are other Canadian governments keeping secrets and trying to strong arm decisions. Coal, last week, the Ontario Information Privacy Commissioner released a jaw-dropping report.
In a new report, the commissioner outlines startling revelations that the government used code words to discuss the Greenbelt, making it difficult to find all the relevant documents. In some cases, there was an absence of records detailing who ordered the changes into the Greenbelt and the general government decision-making. And staff routinely relied on private emails to discuss government business. Some of those records, the commissioner said, were also wiped from existence.
So the process is that the media, any member of public can go to the provincial government, go to a ministry, go to really any public institution and request documentation and information that's supposed to be in the public realm. But when this was going on in Ontario for a couple of years regarding the Greenbelt, another cherished stretch of ecosystem, a few years ago, the Ford government tried to quietly swap out parcels of the Greenbelt right, which is in this incredibly important ecological part of the province. The headwaters, which feed down to Lake Ontario, go through the Greenbelt. There's all kinds of important habitat, and there's a lot of wildlife, a lot of species that depend on a healthy Greenbelt. It's literally called the lungs of the province. And we find out that quietly the Ford government was trying to remove parcels, 15 parcels at one time, of land from the Greenbelt for the development of McMansions. And then we find out that it was preferred developers, many of whom had coincidentally been acquiring lands in the Greenbelt, the exact parcels that later got selected for removal. The government has claimed that that was just a coincidence, or that was just savvy speculation, and it had nothing to do with those, in some cases, same developers influencing behind the scenes PC government officials to have their parcels of land removed. But anyway, through that whole process, there's all these FOI requests that go into the government. And last week, the IPC releases this report saying government officials were using, quote, code words when they were discussing the Greenbelt, when they're putting things in memos and reports and email communication, code words were being used. So, for example, instead of saying the Greenbelt, they would put a capital G with an asterisk so that when an FOI officer or even the IPC might try to find documents relevant to these FOI requests that might, you know, allow us to glean what had been happening behind the scenes, like how were these decisions being made? They were using these code words that returned every single document that had the word G in it. So you could have, like, you know, a report that had the word G in it 400 times. And so that just creates a fire hose of information. But I don't know, Cole, if you followed last month when a somewhat similar report by the Alberta IPC came out, and it said that all 27 Alberta government departments had essentially been violating the province's own privacy rules and FOI rules.
Madam Speaker, Alberta's Privacy Commissioner has confirmed that 27 government departments violated freedom of information laws, denying access, narrowing requests, and blocking public scrutiny in ways the law does not allow. This isn't just administrative failure, it's a direct attack on the public's right to hold their government accountable. How can this government defend violating FOIP legislation while claiming to respect the democratic rights of Albertans?
What do you make of all this?
I think the first thing I would say is that if there's any politicians that listen to this, if you are having to keep things secret from the public, probably shouldn't be doing it. I think that's the number one thing. Probably, you know, it's really unpopular and you probably shouldn't be doing it. But I think it brings up the broader picture of just government, you know, I'm going to call it corruption, where they seem to think that in a sense they own the province that they run and they can just kind of do whatever they want. And it makes you ask the question, what else do we not know? It's very difficult because, like, in the Greenbelt, for example, if they're not being transparent about even mentioning the Greenbelt in their reports and they're trying to hide it, what else are they hiding? Like, what's next? Because surely there's something else. Like, you can't tell me that this is a one-off thing. With Alberta, this has been an ongoing issue of trying to get information. Even the Auditor General trying to conduct reports here on the government, they seem to get delayed and delayed and delayed. It's just more tactics to try and inevitably, I think, sort of drag it out long enough that people forget about it and they don't care about it anymore because they've heard about it for so long, or that they just won't be in office by the time this information comes to light. It's not good. I'll put it blunt. Like, it's not good. People deserve to know what is happening, where money is getting spent, who is getting the opportunity to essentially make money off of these things that are happening, like land being removed from the Greenbelt, and what their relationship is to Doug Ford. So it's concerning. Whether people in the general public think it's concerning or not, I'm unsure. I think people that are politically inclined are very much, you know, we use it as a thing, like if you're somebody who's maybe not a fan of conservative governments, we use it as a way to say, haha, they're not transparent. But I think there's a problem that's even bigger with the general public is that we're so used to politicians being somewhat corrupt and doing these sort of things. They're like, well, you know, that's politicians for you.
It was just reported last week that Nova Scotia Premier Tim Houston has had conversations that would allow Halifax, its mayor Andy Fillmore, to have these strong mayor powers.
It started with bike lanes, and it is leading to worry for some in council with how far provincial overreach will go between Tim Houston's government and Mayor Andy Fillmore.
I'm told now that they will be coming this fall, that the premier finds the mayor, Andy, vacuous and controllable, and now he can run the city by proxy. And so there's this link between the mayor and the premier, and now the premier wants to run Halifax.
I'll read something that was written by Jason Setnick. He's a journalist with the Seaway News that covers Cornwall. And he wrote just last month when Doug Ford and the PC government gave an additional 169 municipalities these strong mayor powers. Quote, these provisions have raised concerns about the erosion of democratic principles at the municipal level. Critics argue that allowing bylaws to pass with only one-third council support, as long as the mayor's behind it, quote, that undermines the foundational concept of majority rule in a representative democracy. The concentration of power in the mayor's office may diminish the role and influence of elected council members, potentially reducing transparency and accountability in local governance. Cole, are you seeing a backslide away from democratic principles in our country?
Yeah, and I think it's happening in a lot of places. And the one thing I would say is I don't think people are fully in tune to how important democracy is until it can directly affect them, which is part of the problem. Democracy is the most important thing we have. Like, without democracy, nothing good can really happen. That means that one person or one group can make all the decisions. And that might be great if you agree with the decisions, but then when you don't get a say and it doesn't matter.
The reason why I bring up the strong mayor powers in connection to all of this is that whether it's the coal magnates in Australia or the developers in the Greenbelt, what drives this push for these strong mayor powers is the private sector, right? Now at the local level, if we move in this direction, one of the things that I fear is that it's a lot of the same playbook. You're seeing a lot of this municipal control being now taken over by provincial governments in Ontario and other places. Well, let's get rid of bike lanes. Let's get rid of safe injection sites. So these things that used to be municipal decisions under municipal jurisdiction, are you noticing that? And it's usually these conservative politicians that seem to be working together at the provincial level. They're mirroring each other's provincial policies, but we're now even seeing it at the municipal level.
Interesting you bring that up. There was a UCP MLA. They are essentially getting involved in bike lanes in Edmonton, you know, not wanting bike lanes in certain areas. And they're saying it's, you know, for the benefit of traffic flow and congestion. But like, we have a Edmonton City Council, whether you like them or not, who is elected. I just don't think that provincial governments should be coming in and saying, no, you can't do this because we've got an investor who doesn't believe in it or our ideology doesn't match up with it. Like, that's not how it's supposed to work. Democracy works by you electing your city council and your mayor. And if that's what city council and the mayor decides to move forward with, great, on a majority basis, not on, you know, special mayor powers or whatever. And then if you don't like it, people can vote them out. That's how democracy works.
And I hope, just like in Fort McLeod, those Edmonton cycling advocates, they get out and they show the Danielle Smith government or whomever is trying to push these policies down their throat what the consequence will be. And there's some transparency around how some of these things are being done so that Edmontonians, just like all Canadians, can fight back against governments who increasingly seem to be trying to slip things past us, trying to pull the wool over our eyes. And whether it's coal mining of the Rockies or bike lanes or protecting the Greenbelt, I just think we need people, we need Canadians, we collectively, we need to take back government.
100% agree.
That's our show for today. Thanks for joining me. You can email me about it at san.grewal@thepointer.com. That's S-A-N, like Nancy, dot G-R-E-W-A-L @thepointer.com. I read everything you send. Cole, where can people find you?
They can find me at cole.notcole on all the major social media platforms. And you can also find me at colenotcole.substack.com, where I send out a daily email. I keep you up to date on all the big things politically happening in Canada and sometimes around the world.
This episode is produced by Jess Schmidt. The associate producer is Lucy Lemonnier, who also did the fact-checking, mixing and mastering by Tristan Capicchione. And our director of audio is Max Collins. The editor and publisher of Canada Land is Jesse Brown. Theme music is by So Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Love podcasts? Want to try your hand at podcasting? Why not make your mark and join CFRC's podcast network? Visit podcast.cfrc.ca. Check out the great podcasts already produced right here at CFRC and find out how you too can have your very own podcast.